welcome to another edition of the Armchair Directors, where each episode we take a look at one of cinema's great directors and their essential films. This week on the show, we are looking at the 2013 film Saving Mr. Banks, directed by John Lee Hancock. With me here today to talk about Saving Mr. Banks is Professor Marie Westhaver. Professor Westhaver, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So this was an interesting choice for the director show, because A, it's very recent, it's only 3 years old. I'm not sure if you would quite put this, well, I do enjoy it, I like the movie, I don't want to say I'm putting it down or anything. I don't think I would put this as like a all-time great or essential film.
No, but it's a great way to look at Disney. Mm-hmm. And Disney himself, of course, really, he's the focus. No, he's the director we're really talking about.
Yeah, and it's interesting. I was reading about the historical accuracy of the film, and what I read is that, spoiler alert, but at the end of the movie, we see P.L. Travers emotionally moved by the screen when she goes to see Mary Poppins, and it's the scene when the father has the redemption at the end. But in the real life, she did not like the movie, from what I've heard. She wasn't happy with how it was done, and she never wanted to work with Disney again for any of her other adaptations of that book series. And I think even in her will, she left that like none of her property could be used for any movies. So they changed that in the film.
She did not like the way Disney treated her character. She thought it was vulgar, and she felt tricked. And when they wanted to make a musical out of the movie, like a Broadway play, mm-hmm. she agreed finally, but only if no Americans were allowed to work on it.
That's funny, because there is that one scene where she's leaving, go back to Britain, and she talks to the cab driver, Paul Giamatti, and she goes, you know, you're the only American I've ever liked.
Yes, and he says, may I ask why? And she says, no.
Nope. But, you know, it does portray a lot of, like, her unwillingness to work with Disney in this movie, though. A lot of it with the creative process and working on the film. She says no, no, no a lot of the time. The main thing is she doesn't want any animation. It almost seems like she doesn't even want to work with it. So in a way, it does portray that. But in the end, it gives it a happy ending. Like, in the end, she finally accepts it and she likes it. But it's funny, in real life, still never really got over that.
But that wouldn't make a good movie. I mean, what mm-hmm. they did was the classic character change, where they start off all crusty mm-hmm. and they're a curmudgeon and nothing ever makes them happy and they insult people. Mm-hmm. And then as time goes on, you sort of warm to them. You know, mm-hmm. it's a wonderful scene when she goes into the Beverly Hills Hotel and it is filled
with Disney stuff.
With Disney stuff. Yeah. And your reaction as an audience member is, wow, wouldn't that be fun? Yeah. Wouldn't you love to go into a room full of Disney stuff? Mm-hmm. But of course, she is not at all pleased, and she is certainly not amused, and she puts Mickey over into the corner.
Yeah, she puts everything away. But then, of course, later when she has trouble sleeping, she gets the big giant yep. Mickey teddy bear thing, and she cuddles up to it when she sleeps. So,
yes.
So she finally accepts the Disney.
See, I'm sure that never happened, but yeah. It makes for a great scene. So mm-hmm. I think it's okay.
And Emma Thompson, I mean, of course, she's one of the great actresses, but she's really good in this film. She, you know, even though she is this curmudgeon, you still like her, and you even still, in the way they incorporate her backstory of stuff that happened with her father when she was a kid. They think they incorporate that well, so you really understand her character, I think.
Yes, you understand why she is the way she is and why she's so protective of all the characters. Emma Thompson did say that she listened to all of those tapes that they made.
Yeah, I did hear about that.
And she said it was like having forks stuck in your ears. She said it was just really difficult to listen to the real P.L. Travers, you know, chewing everybody out and being unpleasant and thinking, okay, how do I, you know, incorporate all this into the character?
Mm-hmm. You always get those creative artists that are just completely difficult to work with and will say no to everything you suggest.
Now, in the movie, the song that kind of brings her around in the studio is Let's Go Fly a Kite. Mm-hmm. But in real life, it was Feed the Birds. That was the song that really brought her around. And interestingly, that was Walt Disney's favorite song.
I did read about that, because you talk about the scene when the one guy is like staying late at night and he's playing the song, and then Disney asks him to play that song, Feed the Birds. I guess that's actually real, because like whenever people were there, they knew the song he wanted to hear, so they said play that song.
Yeah, if he was ever depressed, he would call in those brothers to play that song for him, to the point where they knew what he wanted, and all he would say is play it. Mm-hmm. He thought that song represented why he created Walt Disney Pictures.
Yeah. And moving on to Walt Disney, I think casting Tom Hanks was almost a perfect choice for this movie. You just feel like eventually, because the thing is, Tom Hanks always kind of, he's like, sort of like, he reminds me a bit of a modern day Jimmy Stewart.
Me too.
Where he always just plays the all-American good guy, you know, whether it was Philadelphia or Apollo 13 or Forrest Gump or what, insert movie here.
Sully,
Captain Phillips. He's always a good guy, and it feels like eventually he would have to play Walt Disney, and of course he plays, and like Emma Thompson, he gives a, you understand what Walt Disney, with in that scene when he's like, can you play the song, or even the, you know, the, he's talking about his father and how he loves his father, even though his father was abusive towards him as a kid, and yeah, he was also very good in this movie.
Did you know that he's actually a distant cousin?
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yes, so that was one of the reasons why they wanted him. Mm-hmm. They also knew that he would have the gravitas mm-hmm. to play somebody so beloved and so well-known without making into a caricature. Mm-hmm. And he is great in it. He must have studied Disney very carefully because mm-hmm. the scene where they pull up to Disneyland and, you know, the gates open and he's mm-hmm. standing there. I mean, that's a real pose that he did all the time.
Oh,
and,
really?
And that kind of avuncular, you know, uncle who's, you know, very kind, that kind of cadence that he used, he must have copied that just from,
yeah, because I think I remember reading he would listen to radio interviews and like little short movie script interviews of him
in the Wonderful World of Disney,
and he would
see how he presented himself. Yeah,
he would do that voice, and even I guess there was even a lot of work with that mustache because he had that
mustache. Yes.
And they worked a lot of it just like getting the mustache right so it looked like his, like Walt Disney's mustache.
That, yeah, they actually measured it with a really? Ruler to make sure it was exactly, yes, isn't that funny?
Crazy.
The lengths they go to for accuracy.
Yeah, it was funny, even like the little things they did, like the scene when, you know, she barges into his office and she catches him smoking.
Yes.
I guess that's real, like he was a chain smoker, but he, you know, he figured because he was this guy that ran this kid's enterprise, he thought it would be a bad image of him catching smoking, so he would always like find a little area to be quiet, made sure nobody caught him smoking, and he would smoke.
Yeah, Tom Hanks lobbied to keep that in, you know, to show the accuracy that he was a smoker. And apparently he would always clear his throat before he entered a room. Mm-hmm. So you heard him coming. And what they would say when they heard him coming was, "Man is in the forest," which was a line from Bambi,
really?
Is to tell everybody Walt's on his way. You can tell.
Yeah. And there's actually one scene where he's like, I think he's meeting Travers for the first time and he's coughing and clearing his throat. And you can and like, that's just those little details, those work really well.
Yes.
And so, other performances that stand out, I thought Colin Farrell, you know, once again, another good character in the movie with the alcoholic father. And I like that he isn't like your typical alcoholic dad where he's drunk, he insults the kids, he beats them, he's miserable and everything. He knows what he's doing. You know he's bad. He's got a drinking problem, but he still tries to do his best to cheer up the kids, even though he is kind of a screw up.
Yeah, and he's very fanciful.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what a fun person to grow up with, but not very reliable.
Mm-mm.
But you can see where she got her imagination from, and who gave her permission to let, you know, come up with stories.
Yeah, and even like that scene when they're working on the banking song and it's incorporating the speech he's giving with about the banking convention at the carnival, and like they incorporate that well, you can see that that's where she's getting a lot of her life's influence from.
Yeah, and Colin Farrell is terrific in the role.
Mm-hmm.
Very flawed but likeable, kind of like the P.L. Travers character in a way.
Yeah, exactly. And then another good performance I really liked was, I'll try to do my best Giamatti impression, Paul Giamatti. And he was really funny in the movie, but then again, he's also a good rounded character because, you know, she's annoyed by him because he's always so happy, and even when she insults him, he doesn't like get upset or anything, and you realize that, oh, he has his daughter's handicapped, and it's a good scene when she's like, you know, she writes down all these lists of famous people, like, these people also had problems, like, your daughter can do anything, don't let anything doubt that.
Yeah, and she lists, you know, Helen Keller and mm-hmm. people who overcame adversity, and then she says, oh, and Walt Disney. Because mm-hmm. I think she says, I think she thinks he's
like hyper, he has yes, ADHD or something.
Yes,
that explains everything.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Great lines in there. But you're mm-hmm. right. Paul Giamatti is always the best thing in any movie he's in. He's mm-hmm. always terrific. And he almost steals the movie. He's mm-hmm. so understated and so very likable.
Yeah, he's good. I mean, I've only seen a couple of things. I've seen this, Cinderella Man. He's really good in that. And the John Adams miniseries
fantastic
is also really good.
Fantastic in that series.
Yeah. But he always has this voice where he's getting excited, and it's always funny to me.
No problemo.
Yes. And so the really the strength of this film, I think the best part is when they intercut the flashbacks with her as a kid, just her relationship with her father. And how, because that's really the center of the movie, how she's incorporating that into this movie. And she wants the Mr. Banks character. She gets upset when they make him out to be this horrible person. Like, he's not like that. Just because he does this stuff doesn't mean he's a bad person. I thought incorporating that, and even though it didn't really happen at the end, I thought it was a really emotional scene at the end when she's getting choked up at the Mary Poppins scene when they're talking about their father, and Mary Poppins is defending him like he's not a bad person. And that was the strength of the movie for me.
Absolutely, the characterizations were the strength of the movie for me.
Mm-hmm.
What's funny to me is I remember seeing Mary Poppins as a child. I never even really paid attention to the adults in the movie. Mm. The fact that Mary Poppins comes to save the father and not the children, I didn't get that when I watched that.
Yeah, and I'll have to make my little confession to the whole world right now. I'm not sure if I've ever seen Mary Poppins. I may have seen it as a kid. I remember parts of it, like the paper that gets crumpled up and that brings her there. I mean, of course, I remember the stuff with the dancing penguins and the supercalifragilisticexpialidocious. That's all I can remember. Like, I'm not even sure if I've seen it, so I'll make my little confession. Have you seen it a lot, I'm sure?
I have seen it. I saw it, you know, back in the day, and I've seen it since. And, of course, you know all the songs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like I said, that was just sort of my confession of the movie. I like this movie, but I do point out there's some weaknesses for me. And one of the main thing was it felt like, maybe I'm being a bit cynical, it felt like a commercial for Disney.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe it's just that nowadays, it's just, you look at Disney owning everything now, from Star Wars to the Marvel movies to Pixar to their own stuff, even to like the ABC channel. Even if you're a sports fan, they own ESPN, they own everything. So I feel like this movie is a bit to show how wonderful and amazing Disney is. And like, I felt like that part was a little bit much. It seems like at the end, like when they changed the ending, though, like she's still at the end, she figures out she loves the true greatness of Disney. So that's maybe my one weakness of the film, that it felt like a commercial for the Disney company.
I can see why you would say that, and it's definitely in there. But I think there's things that they do to sort of indicate they're in on the joke, you know, like the overkill of all the stuffed animals, and, you know, that kind of thing, where you're just like, come on already, that's too much. Or even, I thought a wonderful scene was at the Academy Awards when Emma Thompson's character shows up all by herself, P.L. Travers, and then Mickey Mouse shows up
and
escorts her in. I mean, what a perfect
escort.
Escort.
Yeah. Yeah, and then another one, you say that it's really good the way the film builds the characters and everything, but like on a technical standpoint, like I'm not going to say anything's bad or shot poorly or anything, but that said, nothing extremely stands out. It almost felt like the film I watched recently called Fences, where you're more I understand that's sort of the point, but as far as like there's no shots like, well, that's a good shot, or that's really well composed, or there's a lot of good framing, it feels very by the basic. Well, that's not bad, it just doesn't make it necessarily memorable for me.
Well, we'll have to have a whole other show about Fences, but that's based on a play, so it has that stagey feeling more than let's make a really cool shot.
Yeah. But like in this film, like whenever they have the dialogue, it's very like over the shoulder shot, reaction shot, or just, you know, any shots where they're going, it's just very, it's done well, but it's nothing like stands out for me. I just wonder, did you feel like that too, or?
I think everything Disney is very artificial anyway, so maybe I just accept that. I think the strength that kind of plays off of that is it's so a look behind the curtain. You know, you get to see how he wanted to call everybody by their first name, how friendly everybody was. It was like a family of people. Everybody got along great. And so when the P.L. Travers character comes in, she does not fit in to that culture. She doesn't want to be called by her first name, and she doesn't want these trolleys of treats coming in.
Yeah, that was
funny.
Just,
you know, she flies in the face of everything that they do and the way that they do it, which is kind of one of the reasons why I think it's a PR piece for Disney, but it also shows how insular that world was. And if you came from a different perspective.
Yeah. It, like that, the happiness and the friendliness, over-friendliness of that world make it may get a little bit grating to some people.
Yeah.
Like Emma Thompson. But yeah. And so it was interesting looking back at this film. I remember when it came out, I remember seeing a lot of commercials for it, and I think it got a lot of Golden Globe Award nominations. I think Disney really pushed for this to get a Best Picture nod. And it got one Oscar nomination, which was original score by Thomas Newman. But it was kind of considered a shocker that it was very left blank for the Oscars.
Especially since everyone in it did such a great job. It did well at the British Academy Awards. It was nominated BAFTA. At least for a whole bunch of things, for Best Picture, Best Director, Best Actress, Best Costume Design, Best Script, Best Music. So I think everybody noticed it, but nobody really gave it any awards. Yeah.
You know, it's sort of, like I said, like I don't want to keep putting this film down because I do really like it. But, you know, it falls into the category for me, one of those feel-good Oscar bait films.
Yep.
I guess another film that sort of has that same feeling for me, and they're very different, was the King's Speech. King's Speech, on a technical level, very well done, great performances. It's a very good movie, and it won Best Picture, but it's one of those films that you don't really have the hugest urge to keep going back to over and over again. Like, when I think of 2010, I think of something like Inception or Social Network or even the Coen brothers' True Grit, which where I think, I would put all ahead of The King's Speech, even though The King's Speech beat out all of those films for Best Picture. So for this film, which I do like, I mean, I'm not saying I don't like it. I don't want to be too hard on this, but it's a feel-good film. I liked it. If it's on TV again, I might watch it, but will I go out of my way? Will I get the DVD? Will I watch it over and over again? Probably not. And will I think of 2013? Will I think of this movie? No, I probably would think of something like 12 Years a Slave or Gravity or Captain Phillips more than this movie, but still good. So do you feel like that too? Do you feel it's a little bit Oscar baitish?
Yes, I definitely do, because it's so front-loaded with so many famous people, and they're referring to famous people too, beloved people. Yeah. Yes, but I think because it is a feel-good movie, and it has to walk a very fine line between sentimentality and whimsy. Mm-hmm. You want to get that feeling of Disney where there's so much magic. Mm-hmm. The feeling you have when you're a child where you want to go to Disneyland, where it's the pretend world is really something cool. But, you know, you do risk having the story be incredibly corny. Mm-hmm. I think they did a nice job of straddling the true story with the backstory, with little tidbits that make it fun to know because you know a little bit about Disney, but did you know this?
Yeah.
So that, I think you're right, though. It's not a movie that you would go back to watch over and over unless you know really liked one of the songs.
If you're a big Mary Poppins fan, then I could see that. But even you brought up a good point how the Oscar baitish, one of the people criticize the Oscars for is they always go over the top with nominations for movies about movies.
Mm-hmm.
Like La La Land has got a ton of nominations this year, and that's about trying to make it in L.A. One of the characters is trying to be a movie star. You had The Artist, Ode to the Silent Movies. That's a Best Picture winner. A year later, you had Argo, where Hollywood helps the CIA rescue American hostages. You know, you get all these movies, and like even Birdman about a struggling out of his prime Hollywood actor. That wins Best Picture. So it seems like Hollywood always likes those movies about movies, which is almost shocking because they still didn't give this a lot of Oscar love.
Yeah, not even some nominations, which I think it deserved.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so now this movie has getting close to 4 years old. Do you feel that it's sort of, even now, it's kind of, and you don't really hear it talked about anymore? Do you feel it's sort of been forgotten over time? Or
I think it has. The reason it's still evergreen for me is because I use it in my animated film class.
Oh, okay.
You know, we show some, you know, archival footage of the real Walt Disney and, you know, the man behind the mouse kind of stuff. But this movie lets you see it without it being quite so documentary-ish. You know, and it's not really him. It's Tom Hanks. But you see, you get an idea of him in the context of how he was with other people. And I think that's kind of neat.
Okay. And so so we could talk a little bit about John Lee Hancock. Now, before I watched this film, I was like, that guy doesn't ring a bell for me. But then I looked. I've seen a couple of his films. The Rookie, I'm a big baseball fan, so I'll eat up any baseball movie. And I really like that movie. That's with Dennis Quaid. Also based on a true story about a guy who was like in his late 30s, never could get to the big leagues. But it was sort of in the movie, he's a high school baseball coach, and the team's struggling. They say, if we can win state or win regionals or something, you try out for the MLB. So they do, and he tries out. He makes the Tampa Bay Rays for a while. And then the remake of The Alamo, I haven't seen that. But then another movie that was huge at the Oscars quite a few years ago was The Blind Side, mm-hmm. about Michael Orr, who played for the Ravens for quite a few years. And then he's coming up with The Founder. So it seems like he's really latches on to these true story movies.
Sweet stories, too. Mm-hmm. There's a sweetness to all the stories. In fact, I think that Saving Mr. Banks is a little bit like The Blind Side in the feeling it has, that, you know, sweeping story about family and mm-hmm. people coming together. And,
you know, somebody who's a bit hesitant to come into this world. And yes. at the end, they embrace it by the end of it. Yeah.
And actually, the real life person from The Blind Side, Leanne Tui.
The mom?
Yeah, the mom. She is an extra in Saving Mr. Banks. She's in the crowd at Disney World, Disneyland.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
And so, I know you said you haven't seen it yet, but are you probably going to, the Founder movie, it's with Michael Keaton. Michael Keaton's been on a little bit of a roll lately with the last two films. He was in one Best Picture. So, and this movie's about the, not the original guy that created McDonald's, but the guy who kind of stumbles onto it and turns it into this big empire. Was that going to interest you?
Yes, because that's got to be an interesting story too. You know, kind of, again, you know, the man behind the story. You know, who was he? What was mm-hmm. he like? I've seen some trailers for the film, but I haven't seen it yet.
Yeah, it's interesting because I always look up theaters near me and what's going to play. And I remember, and they were saying this was going to come out in like September. And so then in September, nothing came up. So I checked it again. It was like, oh, it's going to come out in like November or December. Nope. Now it's like it's just coming out now, and it's January 2017. So, and it didn't get any it's got nothing at the Oscars.
Right, no buzz.
So I'm starting to wonder if maybe that was sort of like, I know there's a certain date that they have to meet, and if they mm-hmm. don't meet it, I just wonder if that hurt them.
Probably. I think that I'm interested to see what this director does with that topic because of the way he's handled the other ones.
Mm-hmm.
But I wonder if that's more of a DVD movie than a go to see it in the movies.
Yeah. Well, you talked about how his movies like The Blind Side, like The Rookie, or say Mr. Banks are all, you know, feel good. You know, they make you feel good. Like this one doesn't seem like that because I watched the trailer for it and they made Michael Keaton as the kind of a guy who takes advantage of the situation that the McDonald's brothers, they're just fine having one restaurant and everything. And he sort of pushes them into making it a fast food empire. And I think it sort of implies that he sort of screws them over. So I wonder if he's going to take this into a different direction where it's not so feel good. It's more of just like cutthroat, you know, American business style of, you know, survival of the fittest.
I wonder after the movie if you're like dying for some French fries mm-hmm. or never again.
Yeah. Just like, maybe not. Don't want to go to McDonald's.
Right. Yeah. Makes you wonder. I don't know what the general feel is supposed to be once you walk out.
You know, poor McDonald's. Like, movies just rip on McDonald's all the time. You had this, then you had Super Size Me, you know. Poor McDonald's.
Poor McDonald's.
So, we're getting close to the end of my questions here. Is there anything I haven't covered? Oh, I do. I forgot. I guess we could talk about the score by Thomas Newman. This was the only one that got an Oscar nomination. Thomas Newman is a great composer. He's done American Beauty. He's done Shawshank Redemption. He's worked on the last two James Bond films. He's done a whole bunch of stuff when you really look at it. And I thought this was really good music.
Oh, me too. And it's also great that he was nominated because he scored a movie that really was about two really famous songwriters.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the Sherman Brothers, who worked for Disney until he died.
Yeah, and I read that, you know, the Sherman Brothers, I think both of them are still alive. And I was reading that he collaborated with them on this movie, just, you know, when they're going through the process of Let's Go Fly a Kite and they're singing that, he wanted to help incorporate some of their musical scores into his own music. I think you get a little bit of Mary Poppins at the very beginning of that movie when it's the voiceover narration of Colin Farrell and he's reading out that poem. So, yeah, I was right about that. Really good music by Newman, and it was cool that he kind of collaborated with the Sherman Brothers in real life to do that.
And the Sherman Brothers were no slouches either. They had 9 Academy Award nominations, 2 Grammy Awards, 4 Grammy Award nominations, and 23 gold and platinum albums.
Wow.
So they owned the music.
Well, did they win any Oscars, or they did not win any?
They were nominated 9 times.
But none of those were wins?
But no wins.
Wow. Oh, man.
Boy, talking about always a bridesmaid, never a bride.
It's like with Roger Deakins, a cinematographer. He's been nominated 14 times. He's never won once. It's crazy. So we're getting close. Okay, so now I'll ask, is there anything I haven't covered that you want to bring up now?
Well, one fun fact is that Walt Disney's favorite horse in the carousel is named Jingles, just like the little mouse in the Green Mile.
Oh, wow. Another Tom Hanks connection, too.
Exactly. Yeah. And in the film, when Disney is talking about, he knows what it's like to have someone else control the character that you've created, what he's referring to is back in the day when he and Ub Iwerks created a character called Oswald, the Lucky Rabbit, and Universal ended up taking it.
Oh, really?
So they then created Mickey Mouse, which originally was named Mortimer until Disney's wife said, yeah, not Mortimer. How about Mickey? And that became his, you know, flagship character. But first, it was a rabbit. So, and he lost control of the rights.
And when he created Mickey Mouse, did that automatically, was that part of Walt Disney Pictures, or when Mickey Mouse first came out, was that part of another studio company?
No, that was him. I mean, the first movies that he and Ub Iwerks put together were, you know, Trolley Troubles with Oswald the Lucky Rabbit. And then when they lost control out of that, then they came up with Mickey, who looks, by the way, very very much like Oswald. And they did, you know, Steamboat Willie and those.
Steamboat Willie, Okay. Okay, then last question I'll have for you is just tell us a little bit about the classes you got coming up for this spring and maybe how you bring, you talked a little bit earlier, but how you bring Mr. Banks into it.
This semester I am teaching the history of animated film with Dave Hinton, who is our gaming and simulation expert on campus. And we go through, we start from the beginning with, in fact, last week we watched Steamboat Willie and go to present day. So we inevitably have to talk about Walt Disney and his contribution.
Well, of course,
you know, even if you don't want to focus completely on American cinema and American animation, you can't not mention Walt Disney.
Yeah, it'd be impossible.
Impossible. So I like for the students to be able to see this movie because, for one, it tells you a little bit about what went into making Mary Poppins, but also it shows you a little bit about Walt Disney in a good way, you know, and also shows you the backstory of Mary Poppins, which you didn't know. So it's got a lot going for it. It's a good movie.
Okay. Well, that wraps up this episode of The Armchair Directors. We have been looking at director John Lee Hancock and his 2013 hit film, Saving Mr. Banks. Don't forget, you can listen to The Armchair Directors every Thursday at 9:30 a.m., Sunday at 2:30 p.m., or anytime at dragondigitalradio.podbean.com under the category Armchair Directors. Professor Westhaver, I want to thank you again for coming on the show today.
Thanks for having me.
Okay. For The Armchair Directors, I'm your host, Alex Baker, saying, will the child be a nuisance? It's an 11-hour flight.